Broadcasting live from the Business Radio X studios in Atlanta, Georgia, it's time for Atlanta Business Radio, spotlighting the city's best businesses and the people who lead them.
Lee Cantor here with Stone Payton, another episode of Atlanta Business Radio, and this is going to be a good one. We've got a full house here.
We most certainly do. I'm impressed at the level of participation right after the Thanksgiving holiday. This is going to be a fantastic segment. We have gallery participants, so Katie Elizabeth is back with us, so we're delighted to have her supervising, if you will. And a little bit later in the program, we are going to hear from facilitator, strategist, and visual thinker Julie Stewart. She is with Making Ideas Visible. We're also going to catch up with Beth Summers. She's director of corporate meetings over at Rome down the street. We got to get down
and
there
all
visit.
Over the place now.
Yeah, yes. they're everywhere. We're also going to get a chance to talk with Bijan Kasavi. How'd I do?
Perfect.
He's learned to say perfect. Yeah. But first up on Atlanta Business Radio this afternoon, it is my distinct pleasure to introduce the founder and managing partner with Butler Street LLC. Please join me in welcoming to the show Mr. Mike Jacoteau. Welcome to the show, man.
Thanks, Tom. Appreciate it.
Now, Butler Street Consulting, what are you guys doing for folks?
Well, put simply, we help companies and their people grow. We're a performance improvement company that focuses on helping customers acquire, retain, and develop two of their most important assets, the clients and the talent.
The clients and the talent. You work both sides of the street?
Both sides of the street. One without the other doesn't work.
So when you begin an engagement, where do you typically work?
We typically start with client retention.
Client retention?
Right.
And what are some mistakes that companies make when it comes to client retention?
Well, I would tell you that our research shows that over 80% of companies don't even measure client retention. So that's mistake number one. 80%, yeah.
So now, what is their retention rate on average?
Well, retention rates, depending on the industry, can range from business to business from a low of about 65% to a high of about 95%.
That's year over year?
Yeah, year over year.
And then... What have you ever seen 100%?
My old companies came in at about 99, yeah.
So there are some ways that you can make improvements.
Oh, absolutely, yeah.
And what's some of the low-hanging fruit?
Well, the first thing that you have to understand is when you take a step back and you decide what business you're in the customer business. Your most important asset is obviously your customer base, right? I mean, mm-hmm. You think about a company, what is a company's revenue? It's customer money. What's your paycheck made up of? It's customer money.
Right.
So when you take a step back and you realize, you know, you only have two types of employees in your company, those who serve the customers and those who serve the customers. It's not a difficult concept to understand, yet what we find, we surveyed 112 companies, only two companies even measured client risk. So as I travel the country, I ask people, I do sessions in front of CEOs all over the country, one of the big questions I ask them, are your clients at risk? And they all nod their head, yes. Then I say, well, who's at risk? How much are they at risk? What are you doing to mitigate the risk? And that's when I typically get the deer in the headlights. So we've built a proprietary client risk analysis. Every Monday morning as a CEO, and I spent the last 9 years as a CEO of two national companies, I get a report, red, yellow, green, telling me who's at risk, how much they're at risk, and what we need to do to mitigate that risk.
And then how are you defining risk?
Well, there are a number of factors that define risk. For example, relationships. One of the key risk factors is if there's a management change on either side of the fence, everything has an opportunity to change. So, for example, if your key decision maker ups and leaves, quits, gets fired, whatever, you're at risk.
And does that move you like from green to yellow at
yeah,
that point?
Yeah, that'll move you. Sometimes it'll move you into red. Yeah. So there's that. There's number of relationships. Are the relationships competitive? Are they cooperative? Are they collaborative? Each of those has a numerical value. We feed that into an algorithm. We can come back and tell you exactly who's at risk and how much they're at risk.
So why do you call it Butler Street?
Yeah, that's always the question that that I get. You know, the stuff that we do, it's like a butler. You could do it yourself, but we just do it so much better.
Very creative.
All right, so you have, there's the retention element and there's the expansion element. Mm-hmm. So you help bring new people, you onboard new people, new employees?
Yeah, if you think about client acquisition, retention, and expansion, we start with retention. If you do that well, you have opportunities to expand within the customer, cross-sell different products and services, and really get the most out of that client relationship. On the talent side, it's about acquisition or hiring, onboarding the talent. So it's about acquisition, retention, and development of the talent, because one without the other doesn't work.
So now when it comes to client or employee development, now some of your employees are salespeople and customer facing, right? And that's an element of it. Is it possible to teach these people to be salespeople, or do you have to kind of choose the right people going in?
No, I think the salesperson has a different type of mentality. What makes a salesperson great is their optimism, which makes them at risk in a client risk analysis is their optimism. So if you think about it, they'll tell you everything's going great until we bring this numerical
system.
That's
why you need these numbers to kind of quantify so we can define what good is.
Yeah, we have the old "in God we trust, all others must use" data, right? So
even salespeople.
Exactly. You got to make sure that it's fact-based and data-driven.
Mm-hmm. Now, how'd you come up with this proprietary methodology?
Well, when I became CEO of a company, I had to write a big check as part of the private equity investment. They invest $100 million. They want you to cough up a little scratch yourself. Mm-hmm. So I sat back. We acquired a company, and I said, oh, my God, I don't know what I'm acquiring here. Think about it. I'm acquiring a set of customers that and sales teams and people that I don't know if they're at risk. So my chief operating officer, who's also with me now at Butler Street, we sat down and we said, okay, what are the driving factors? Types of relationships, number of relationships, management chain, relationships with key decision makers. All of these in this day and age have a numerical value, and you can start to predict with great accuracy if your client's at risk. So we used it ourselves for I guess we've been building it now for 17 years, and that's why we use the client and talent development perfected line, because I think we're there now.
And then does this work in certain industries better than other industries? Like, does it work in healthcare as well as it would work in IT?
Yeah, what we do is we do a two-day knowledge team. We walk in, you know, because we're one part consulting company, one part training company, I'd like to think we take the best of both. We're big believers prescription before diagnosis equals malpractice. There's your healthcare quote. So we go in and meet with key players and understand what are the driving forces. And there's really about 16 driving forces for client risk, but they're heavily weighted in some industries.
But you're not just taking their word for it, are you?
No, we have complete research and data that supports it. And sometimes we get them at a coachable moment. We have to say, well, that's real interesting, but the data does not bear that out.
But don't you run into some of the same stuff over and over? Like, what are some of those patterns that you just walk in and I'm sure you're polite about it, but you look at your partner and you roll your eyes and you go, here we go again. It's another one, you know, they're messing up on number four, right?
No, you're absolutely right. it's the 80-20 rule. I mean, there really are about four or five things that drive client risk. It's amazing. If you picture a pyramid, and I'm doing a pyramid sign here.
Yes, that's right.
And if you
we
break,
need you, Julie.
It's more of a triangle, but
triangle.
I'll go with
okay.
it.
But if you think about the bottom third being competitive, where you're most polarized, and as you move up, it becomes cooperative to the top where you're in collaborative, salespeople typically don't understand where they are in a relationship pyramid. So one of the big exercises we do in our knowledge team is to scatter diagram your relationships with your customers. We get them to do it. We ask them a few qualifying questions. And we watch everything come down the pyramid. So it's fascinating.
So you, we keep getting back to the sales because that seems like sales is kind of its own little animal in this.
Well, everybody wants to grow, right? That's the key. Growth is the oxygen of a business. So when we get in, people always want acquisition, retention, expansion first.
Now, but when you're dealing with the salesperson, you're dealing with their optimism, which is necessary for the person to be kind of wagging their tail every day. You don't want them to be like Mr. Doom and Gloom guy, right?
Exactly.
So you need that part, but he's also has a tendency to maybe overinflate where certain relationships are.
No.
You might have run into that on occasion.
On occasion, yes.
And how do you manage the, well, I know we're good with that relationship because I play golf with him every, you know, Thursday. So I know we're good. And then you're telling, well, according to my research, you're at risk or we're going to have to knock it down.
Yeah, there's a boatload of questions that we ask about that relationship. First off, is it a relationship? I'm sure everybody in the room here would agree. If you have one relationship, that's less value than if you have four relationships.
So even with the CEO?
Yeah, I can tell you a very sad story about a guy who was wired into a CEO at 38 years old and unfortunately lost his life. True story. Single threaded relationship, knew no one else in the account. Guess what? he was at risk.
Right.
So we push our clients, we say all the time, you got to be at least 3x3. Three people on your side, because you turn over on your side as well.
Right.
And three people on their side. And that's what you're shooting for to get at least a good level of client risk.
And then so that helps you manage any kind of curveball that
exactly.
might occur.
Exactly. I mean, that's what you're there for. Your job is to provide for the continuation of business over time, personnel change, absence.
So how do you get them to get that three deep within the relationship?
You make them aware of it first. It seems like it's a funny thing, but exactly your point. Where you sit back and say, well, I'm wired.
Look, I don't need anybody else. I got this.
Exactly.
Right?
And then that person quits, and you are highly exposed.
Now you're at a lot of risk.
Exactly.
So what are some elegant ways to add these other kind of bodies into the mix?
Well, the first thing you want to do is identify the relationship, and that's how I come back to the relationship pyramid. Even though you think you have this great collaborative relationship, have you been able to raise prices in the last year? Do you speak at their company events? Do they speak at your company events? You start to think about, because in a collaborative relationship, you really can't tell the buyer from the seller. You're so wired.
Because you're working kind
together.
Of in tandem
yeah.
as a partner, not
exactly.
a vendor.
You're like a strategic thought partner for them. If you're in a cooperative relationship, it's a give and take. Mm-hmm. It's kind of a win-win. If you're in a competitive relationship, customer really doesn't care about you. You might as well be a hot dog vendor. I win, you lose. That's the game plan. But just making them aware of where they are in a relationship map is the first step towards knowledge.
Now, in sports, sometimes, like if you're playing tennis, you want to move from a defensive position to a neutral position to an offensive position. Does the same kind of, very similar.
Great analogy. We talk about advancing the relationship. We tell people that relationships with customers are like stock tickers. Or relationships with anybody. Let's talk about our spouses. Sometimes we're trading up, sometimes we're trading down. But that ticker is always in motion. And it's the same principle with client relationships, depending on who's coming in, because you'll never see a client who is static in terms of their strategic initiatives, their objectives year over year. So the object is to stay close with that client and understand as they change, you can mutate, evolve, and change with them.
So now how do you move up kind of that relationship ladder?
Well, one of the things we recommend are quarterly business reviews. It's so funny because mm-hmm. we'll work with I'm talking about multi-billion dollar companies, and we'll sit down and they say, we think we're at risk, and we'll do a quick risk analysis, and we'll say, wow, yeah, master of the obvious, yeah, you're at risk. When was the last time you did a quarterly business review? And they say, what? Now, since we were in first grade, we got report cards every quarter, right? We knew exactly how
exactly.
we were doing.
You know where you stood.
Exactly. So now you're in the business world. And you've got a $3 million account that you've really not sat down with them and said, okay, here's what we've said we were going to do. Here's what we did. Here's the gap in our performance. Can you give us some enlightenment on your strategic initiatives for next quarter so we can align with those? And that is the first step towards advancing the relationship.
And that sounds very common sense. Nobody can argue that, right?
No, I don't think so, no.
Do you ever get pushback?
We do.
Because it's like, look, I got a 5-year contract. I don't have to worry about them for 3 more years.
Yeah, but that's the thing that people don't realize. And everything in life is in motion. The competition is on you. The fact that you signed a 5-year contract, they want that 5-year contract. So they'll hover around and try to do anything that they can to unseat you. The key, though, you asked a great question. Do they ever argue that point? Yes, because they have this low self-esteem. Customer doesn't want to meet with us. You know, they're too busy.
Or they'll bring up something bad.
That's
I don't want to
one.
Start bad.
Exactly.
Then they're going to yell at me about 50 things.
It's a lot easier to stick my head in the sand and hope is my strategy, right?
Is that true?
Yeah.
You find that even at like billion-dollar companies, see that?
Yeah, because the salesperson, you know, no news is good news in some cases. They don't know what's going on. I'm amazed a key decision maker changes. Our system provides that key decision maker changes. If you get it at a high level, or another one, a great one is a consultant comes in from the outside. When was the last time?
That's a danger sign, right?
That what that does in our system, it goes red immediately.
Red flags.
It sends an email to the CEO. You're in deep doo-doo. It actually says there's a consultant in one of your major accounts. You need to respond.
Because you've never met a consultant that says, everything's good here. We're good. Thumbs up. Great job. High fives.
That's right. And we did open I Am a Consultant, right?
Yeah. I am too.
Oh, marvelous.
Exactly. Making friends here.
So, Larry Kay, because I can't pronounce his last
Kilstadius.
Name. Yeah, yes. What you said. he suggested that we invite you to come on the show, and I'm so glad that he did. But he's like a grand poobah regionally here of this outfit called Vistage. Can you give us your perspective on that group or groups like that as a practical tool to help senior level executives grow into the job that is so big.
Absolutely. You know, I love Vistage. I think the concept is a great one. They build an advisory board of peers. You know, you're running a $10, $20, $50 million company. It's not a lot of people you can go to for advice at that point if you don't have a sophisticated board of directors. So Vistage provides this network of people who are running their own companies. They meet once a month, almost like a board meeting. They talk about what they can do to improve their business, and they hold each other accountable. So it's a really neat situation. My son runs his own business, and I've encouraged him to join Vistage. That's how good I think the Vistage model is.
Now, when you're working with clients, do you find that Vistage organizations that are part of the Vistage network are better performing, or do you notice any difference in terms of you know, how the Vistage run groups are behaving in the real world?
That's a tough one. The Vistage companies that I work with are all very well-performing companies. So, you know, my point would be that I don't know if that's because Vistage is able to bring in just great companies.
Or they just attract,
yeah,
right.
But you think about it, they're smart enough to get in the group.
Well, they know that they need help. I mean, that says something, right?
Exactly. Because, you know, when you think about it, you don't ever want to be, as a CEO, the emperor with no clothes. You know, people will tell you you're great, and then all of a sudden you're sitting in a meeting where somebody's doing something way better than you, and you're like, wow, I'm at a coachable
network,
moment.
Right?
Yeah, exactly.
And they are just that, coachable.
Right, right.
Which
exactly.
I think, yeah.
And now, in your business, you mentioned that you're a consulting firm and a training company. Is one more rewarding for you than the other?
You know, it's interesting because I talk about that with my partners all the time. And I would say that we are, as an organization, we're the best of both. We're very diagnostically oriented. You know, it's the prescription before diagnosis thing. You know, we try to seek to understand before asking to be understood. So we got that from the consulting side. But I think on the training side, where most training companies want to put something in place that they know, we customize everything, and we build a system of reinforcing activities. If you think, Peter Drucker had a line years ago, why strategy, culture eats strategy for breakfast. Because if your culture doesn't allow for continuous learning and development, you could have the greatest strategy. We could walk in there and fall flat on our face. So we spend a lot of time analyzing the company's ability to drive change in their own organization.
And then you customize that change to the level of ability?
They can only move at the pace of which their people can absorb.
Even though maybe leadership wants them to move faster?
Yeah. I mean, you got to slow. That's where you got to sit in front of leadership. And that's where, being a CEO for 9 years, I have some street cred, because I can sit back and say, hey, I stepped on that landmine.
Right.
I know they'll yes you to death, but it's like the movie Jerry Maguire. After the mission statement, they'll go back to work.
Right.
So... Yeah.
So now, what's the pain that the company's having they say, I got to call Butler Street?
Typically, there's two types of customers that we have. The one that we're probably doing more with are companies that are doing well, and they see that we have a client risk analysis. We have, you know, when we do our speaking circuit, and there's I got to have that. And they're smart because they see a deficiency. Even though things are going great, they're still building for the future. The other type of company is that company, what I call it, a teachable or coachable moment. They've lost a major account, and they say, oh, my God, what are we going to do?
Like, had we missed this?
Exactly. And we walk in, and we show them, we become masters of the obvious at that point. Well, you had a single-threaded relationship.
Well,
there you go.
Don't do that again.
Exactly.
So where can our listeners go to learn more? Website, email, phone?
Yeah, it's ButlerStreetLLC.com. Or look, you know, go to the website where we have a lot of speaking engagements around the country, and be happy to meet you there.
Well, I am really glad that you joined us this afternoon. We got to do this again, and maybe with a client or two.
Oh, that'd be great.
I think it would be fun to maybe.
Do you have a local
client?
Yes, actually, we do.
Would you come back and?
Well, is it a single thread relationship?
Yeah, you don't want that.
Is this thing a Jeopardy?
I recommend
a
3x3.
Exactly. Would you think I'd be anything less? Come on. We need our own dog food.
Okay, so we'll get together and we'll talk that through. I think that would be fantastic. Shout out to you, Larry Kay. Thanks for putting this together.
Great.
And if you would, please hang out with us. We're going to leave your microphone open.
Don't want to do that.
No, you might have a really good question or idea, but hang out with us while we visit with our other guests, will you?
Will do. Thanks.
All right. Next up on Atlanta Business Radio this afternoon, we have with us Bijan Kosabi. He is the Grand Poobah, the managing partner, the man in charge, or at least one of the folks over there at Inbounce. Welcome to the show, sir.
Thank you.
So tell us, what'd you learn, if anything, out of that last segment?
Do you like that?
actually very fascinating. I mean, what Mike is doing is just absolutely unbelievable, and is such a needed service in the industry, not only here, but also throughout the country. I mean, this is a customer retention versus customer acquisition. If you look at the cost curve for both, is quite different. So very different than what I do, but
so why don't you
definitely
share,
very fascinating.
So what are you? Why don't you share what Inbounce is up to?
Okay, so I'm a serial entrepreneur and investor. I have built three companies, one in Silicon Valley, one in Atlanta, one in Boston, and in the last 2-3 years, we've been investing in 5 to 8 companies on a global basis. You know, we have investment in Amsterdam, we have investment in Toronto, in Silicon Valley.
How's your Atlanta, portfolio?
I want to really talk about that, because that is really... has tremendous amount of potential.
Yeah.
I
just, how's your media portfolio?
I just, sorry?
Your media portfolio, how's that?
Media is
a little bit thin?
No, it is actually, multimedia is one of our segments.
Okay.
Yeah, multimedia is a very growing segment. Gaming, multimedia, security, information, technology.
So how does Atlanta rank in the globe, since you've been around the block a little bit?
Yeah, that's a great question. Great question. I mean, I just did an article in Forbes, and the title of article was, Will Atlanta Become a Hotbed of Startups? And in this article, I actually outlined my own experience coming to Atlanta. I came to Atlanta 14 years ago, in year 2000, from Silicon Valley.
Mm-hmm.
And I had just sold my company in Silicon Valley in 1999, beginning of 2000. And I was looking for a large number of engineers to build my next company.
Okay.
And in Silicon Valley, at that time, if you wanted to hire an engineer, they would not send you a resume. They just come in to the interview with 3 other offer letters. So you had to match.
Oh, that's great.
So
there was a little bit of opportunity in Silicon Valley.
Precisely.
Back then.
So I call a good buddy of mine who then was working at Scientific Atlanta. I said, hey, buddy, you know, I need some engineers. How many do you think we can hire in Atlanta? And he said, let me think about it and get back to you in a couple of days.
But why'd you pick Atlanta? I mean, you could have picked any city.
Because of the number of engineers.
Okay,
because
so you
of the
had,
talents.
So you thought that there was some engineers here?
Oh, because of this, you know, friend that came in with a spreadsheet.
Uh-huh.
And when I looked at that spreadsheet, there were like PhDs, master, 10 years of experience.
Okay, so...
And the list of... on that spreadsheet was at least 2 or 3 companies I could do. So I said, all right, we pack, we move.
So were you surprised by that information?
I was very surprised because at that time I was looking at Washington, D.C., Austin, Toronto, and also was considered in Silicon Valley, but it was not my first choice.
Right.
And then when Atlanta came about with that number of engineers, I said, we're going to Atlanta, because we didn't have time to just look and assess other locations. As soon as Atlanta showed up with this list of 43, I said, if there is 43 on this list, there are probably 400 that
right.
are not. Mm. So I got a Delta flight, came down, got a hotel in Marriott in Alpharetta.
Mm-hmm.
The hotel was at a suite there on the weekend, 128. We called the company 128.
So naming is an important part of your business?
Absolutely. We called the company at that time 128, and I hired 5 of the 43.
So right
the
there?
The first week.
Within a week?
Within a week, and we were in that suite. And it took us about 30 days to put the business plan together. I went... talked to my wife, and we essentially moved to Atlanta a couple months later. And within, I say, 30, 60 days, we hired about 30 engineers.
So that at no point you're regretting your decision, no second thoughts?
Oh, because we build the company from that idea. We build the company with
he
300.
Wife, not ex-wife.
Right. with 300 engineers. Thank you. With, you know, we built the company with 300 engineers.
So now,
and we sold it in 2006. Mm-hmm. So we started in year 2000.
Right.
And in 2006, we sold it to a German-based company. That company still is located here. And now from that 300, they're actually employing more than that. I think the number is close to 400.
Wow.
So Atlanta has been actually a very good hotbed for that particular technology. Georgia Tech was tremendous help. At that time, if you remember, there was a program by Roy Barnes called Yamakra. You guys need to check that. I think that anyone who's listening to this, they got to go back and take a look at the Yamakra program, because it was very encouraging for companies like I was building to stay in Atlanta and leverage. And that program worked very closely with Georgia Tech. We did a phenomenal work with Georgia Tech. We invented certain technology with Georgia Tech in 2000, 2001, 2003 that became a differentiating product. And as a result, 6 years later, we sold the company.
So this was a private enterprise working with a university kind
Absolutely.
Of collaboratively.
In a very collaborative way.
Yeah. And is that something that's unusual, or you see that a lot?
I think that it is somewhat unusual, but people who are looking for gym, in my opinion, they have to go to the first university and start looking at the IP. A second article came out that I put together with Forbes today, actually. And this is all about how to go to university and leverage the university's talents and leverage the IP that they already have and build companies around that. Mm-hmm. Tremendous amount of gems that only require some polishing.
And so that's what your recent Forbes
yes,
article is about?
Exactly. It came out this morning. If you look at it on in Forbes' blog, is that I can email it to you.
So now at this stage in your career, having started and sold multiple businesses and working so well with the university system, how do you feel about all the co-working and incubator spaces that are popping up all over the place?
Okay, so that is the hot conversation, because we're about to create, we haven't made the announcement. This is the first time I'm making a comment.
It's breaking news.
We got the scoop.
Exactly. Yeah, we are. We have not announced it. I guess the plan is mid-January, but we're creating a startup center, we call it. And let me describe what it is. I'm kind of very familiar with Rome, actually. Great embed. It is called Alpha X.
And we're Radio X.
And excellent. It's called Alpha X. And we are a startup center that deals with three phases of startup requirements.
Okay.
Phase one is incubating, seeding, incubating, getting the product to market.
So is
and
this,
that is what
am I on my napkin here?
Yes.
Or
no,
I can
no.
have a prototype? Where am I at here?
Great. You have a napkin when you come to the door. You have a very good business plan. You have a good value proposition. You will have an alpha plus close to sort of a beta product when you get out.
So I don't have to have a paying customer yet.
No. That is the incubating sort
okay.
of phase. The second phase, what we call it, is a growth phase. And this is something that we do as well. That's what we call ourselves, startup centers, right?
An
incubator.
Instead of an right.
incubator, right. So the second part is growth phase. Growth phase, we help that idea that now became a product to get VC fundings, and we facilitate Silicon Valley, Boston, tier one venture investors to come in. We also will invest with the lead investors from those geographic. I truly believe that smart money, tier one VCs, are critical to the success of the company. I can give you an example of similar products, one in California and one in Atlanta. The one in California became a company, went public, and today is about $8 billion market cap. The one in Atlanta, exact same product, eight years later today, they're hunting for $5 million funding so they can pay payroll.
And it's similar? Or it's
and exact similar product. The difference, the guys in California, they have their smart money.
And then
and
how are you defining smart money?
Okay,
because
so
money isn't just money, right?
Right. Smart money is what the guys invested in Twitter. the guys who invested in Facebook, the guys who invested in Google, because they put the money in and they helped the management and entrepreneurs to grow the company, to product, to get to market, compete, and become multi-billion dollar company.
But they're
that
not,
experience is huge, and we lack that in Atlanta.
But it's also, isn't it, the? It's not just the money to pay for the payroll. It's also the, I know that CEO over there that's going to beta this
you
thing, and
got
I got
it.
This big company over here
you
that you can roll out over here and test it in. The, in the Northeast, right?
So I tell you first example or first experience. My first company I created in Silicon Valley. Mm-hmm. It was in 1996, and Kleiner Perkin, which is one of the largest.
Sure.
Yeah. Vinod Khosla was actually the one that approached me, and we had a conversation from Kleiner Perkin, and then he and I, we essentially put the seed of this idea together. And I can tell you, Vinod is the founder of Sun Microsystem,
mm-hmm.
and he invested into a number of companies, including, I believe, Google and other companies. The level of opening doors and level of helping us to go from point A to point B was unmatched. He could pick up a phone and call someone in Denver, and next day I was in a C-level office having a conversation. On my own, I would not be able to do that.
Right.
We sold that company for $4.3 billion after 5 years, 4.5 years, in March of 2000. So, and it would not have happened because of the product. It would not have happened because of, you know, marketing. It only happened because of the smart money, Vinod.
Now, Mike, I'm going to bring you back in here. You have the CEO cred you were bragging about earlier, remember?
Bragging about being fact-based.
Fact-based. Is that true what he said, that sometimes that at that level, if somebody comes to you that you respect in the industry and they say, hey, I'm funding this firm, do you can they get on your radar to see if there's some sort of fit there that could fast-forward the growth of a company?
Absolutely. I mean, one of the things that we push our clients for is referrals. Mm-hmm. If you are, we use a Net Promoter Score, so customers rate you a 10, first thing you do is you know of anybody else that could use our services. The key here is, you know, companies get paid to say how great they are.
Right.
People like that do not. So it's instant credibility when they say, hey, you've got to come in and listen to these guys. They've got something that you need to hear.
So there is something to this smart money as opposed to just money.
Yeah, I spent the last 9 years with private equity, and those guys could open doors that you couldn't get opened anywhere else.
And when you people, when you guys are
really
are saying open doors, can you define what open is? Is it really like, hey, you should do this, or is it?
Let me give you an example. Mark Andreessen, you know him?
Yes.
Okay, so he has now. He's one of the largest, more sought out venture capital person in Silicon Valley and in the world. He's probably bigger now than anyone from the previous generation. He's becoming like a super agent for startups. He has 40 people on the staff that all they do is business development, on the hiring, on the customer front, on partnership, on opening doors for their companies. And that service is priceless.
And and that could make or break a company.
Precisely. They just invested in one of the companies, Airbnb. They invested about $100 million in Airbnb. I know about the valuation. I don't know whether it's a public information or not, but it's multi-billion dollars.
Sure.
Okay? This company will go public at 10x at the minimum of what they invested. Why? Because these guys invested $100 million. A, they sucked the air from any other competitors. B, they're there with 40 people as business development helping this company go. I mean, it is an unbelievable force when you have that behind you. The CEO of Airbnb will sit there and just, you know, he's going to probably put 80 hours a day, but very happy 80 hours a week.
So now, with your startup center, are you looking for applicants right now? What stage are you at?
So we are, I like to come back, actually, go through the entire announcement, because we do have some partners that I don't have the liberty to announce it now. And it is under sort of a announcement is coming probably in early January. But from an applicant perspective, the process that we have is that we'll make an announcement on when we're going to accept applicants and applications, actually. And our plan is to take somewhere between 50 to 100 companies.
And the Atlanta base, or they have to move here? What is the requirement?
It is the southeast, centered in Atlanta and suburb of Atlanta. Mm-hmm. So we may have multi-locations. We're making those announcements in 30 days. But it is focused in southeast, centered in Atlanta. So companies in Florida, North Carolina, Tennessee, and other places will have to come to Atlanta. And then I want to keep them here by bringing the investments and really leveraging those talents towards building those companies.
So I'd like to leave our some of our aspiring entrepreneurs out there with some counsel, with some advice from you. As they're thinking through this, what are some things that they can and should do or should not do in preparing to have conversations with people like you or in preparing to be a part of an effort like this? Because I suspect, like you, you probably see the same mistakes and the same undone stuff over and over and over. So what are some advice you could offer them?
So first of all, my first advice is that failure is part of the game. So just take it in, another breath, another day, go for it faster. So that's number one. Second is you have to surround yourself with good engineers and good technical individuals, okay? And that is, you know, that is not to call your buddy at high school or college. and that is not to call your uncle or your mom and trying to find some family friends.
Right.
Go after the best and the brightest. And I know so many people that have done that, and they got such a talent given the social media access. So that's number one. Second, I would not do family friend funding, but I would go to angel investors or go to a nearest incubators and trying to build the product from a napkin that you mentioned to something that you can show. And the third thing is to get two or three strong board members, people that have actually have experience in building startups. Not necessarily the CEO of a major corporation, because that CEO of a major corporation that just retired doesn't know about startups. Mm. You need to get the startup guys. The guys that actually build technology startup. That's my, you know, that's right. My area of focus. And bring that on board and then going after tier one venture capital. So those are the steps.
So now once an applicant or a team is accepted into your program, what can they expect?
So we're going to assign a partner and a couple of mentors to that company. We have about 50 mentors. They're located globally, actually, not from Atlanta only. It's
right,
20%
so
in Atlanta, but the rest are elsewhere.
And then was that by design?
Absolutely.
You wanted it to
Absolutely.
Be a global
Absolutely.
Experience for the applicant.
The thing is that in Atlanta, we got a lot of capabilities, but we need to go outside Atlanta in Silicon Valley to get a different DNA of building companies in Atlanta. So I want to bring that sort of a skill set, mm-hmm. You know, to Atlanta. So what we do, we assign a partner, we assign a couple of mentors to that company, and they would work as a team for that period of, let's say, 3 to 6 months to get to a point that they're fundable. Idea, 9 out of 10 great ideas are not fundable. Okay? So, and people should just, if it's not fundable, just give it up, go to something else, right? But the one that is fundable is huge. I mean, you know, if you have the right mix and right business plan and right pitch, you can attract tier one investors.
Mm-hmm.
If you don't have the right pitch and the right business plan, you will not. And what I advise people, and you mentioned that, you know, what do you advise, is that when you call a venture capital firm and set up a time, your objective should not be to have the first meeting and go in and have a good first meeting. From a get-go, your objective has to be, how do I get the second meeting while I go? If you have that in mind, that I'm going in to establish and actually schedule a second meeting, you're 80% there.
So your objective is more to create interest and intrigue rather than to close a deal.
Right. I've done companies in Valley, in Atlanta, in Boston. I've been dealing with first-tier ventures for a long time. I think throughout my career, probably I raised more than $400 million from tier one venture capital firms and working with them as a partner. And I know what they're looking for. They're like 10 to 20, you know, sort of a due diligence list that they go through. Some of them makes complete sense. Some of them don't. And if you know how to answer those, they go through the list. Mentally, they go through the list. They keep liking you more, liking me more. Mm-hmm. If there's 20 by 5 and 6 and 7, you may have a check already.
But that's where working with a like you is an advantage as a, like you said, friends and family that they're going to give you. That's not smart money, right?
That's not. I mean, you get the money. You get, you know, you do something. And then, you know, when you work with the right entrepreneurs, I mean, I should say ATV, for example, in Atlanta, they've done a phenomenal job. ATDC with Steve Fleming leadership there, they've done an amazing job. Rome, I mean, you guys are doing, you know, great job. So you got to work with entrepreneurs, with the technologists that can actually look at the idea and see how this idea can turn into a product that somebody is willing to pay for it with the right margin. So objective is not to build a product. Objective is to make money.
Right. So now if a company wanted to get involved, do you have a website?
Actually, the website is not up because we're not launching it yet.
So
it's called
days.
Alpha. I would say in 30 days it would be alphax.com. Is the website. My own website, my own sort of investment website is www.inbounds.com. And people can follow me on Twitter with my first name, last name, at Bijan Khosravi. That's at BijanKhosravi.
Spelled exactly how it sounds.
And they can just go to Forbes and read all your articles. Seems like you're writing an article every few weeks now.
Every few weeks, exactly. We're trying to, we got some ideas and some perspectives. And we believe Atlanta is just such a phenomenal place. If we could get some smart money to come down to Atlanta, we could have one or two billion dollars.
We got you, John.
We need more.
We're halfway there.
You're too kind.
Well, and we'll transcribe this and send it to Forbes, and then you won't have to work so hard next month, and you'll be set. No, so you mentioned coming back in early January or early next quarter. I think that makes a lot of sense. Or we'll come to you, to your facility, but I think that makes a lot of sense.
That would be good. In our facility, would be better. I have other partners, and
all right, so let's
do that. More than just us. There is a lot of other businesses.
There's an ecosystem.
Ecosystem, correct.
Yeah. All right, well, we'll come to you then.
Yeah,
fantastic. Hey, hang out with us. We got a couple more folks we're going to visit with. All right, next up on Atlanta Business Radio this afternoon, we have with us no stranger to the Business Radio X microphone, Director of Corporate Meetings for Rome, that's ROAM, Miss Beth Summers. Welcome back.
Thank you for having me back.
Well, we are delighted to have you. What's going on over there at, should I say Rome or the Romes? Or there's more than one now, right?
There are. There is one in Alpharetta.
Right.
That was the first one. It's been there for 5 years. And then we opened up a second facility in May a year ago, so a little over a year, here in Dunwoody on the Sandy Springs line. And then we are opening up Cobb Galleria and Buckhead in late spring, early summer of 2015.
There's no stopping these folks.
Very excited. Very excited.
For the two people who aren't familiar with Rome, can you share a little bit about what happens when you go inside?
Absolutely. Rome is an innovator's workplace and meeting facility. So what that means is it's a co-working facility. And you can come and co-work in different types of space that we have, and I'll go into that in just a minute. And we have meeting facility. So for any company that would like to have off-site meetings, not inside their own, you know, meeting space that they might have, they could come to our facility and have a meeting with breakfast, lunch, what have you, whatever your needs are. So the co-working space itself. Well, first, let me get back to tell you how we came about.
Well, that's also, first things first. Do you have espresso?
Absolutely. Okay. We have a great coffee bar. So it started in Alpharetta. A few IBMers got together and started meeting at a coffee shop off Windward Parkway. And they decided to come up with this concept of this co-working space. And then they bought the coffee shop. And then they actually sold the concept to two investors at the time. That's how Roam came about. So these IBMers are a perfect example of why we exist. They were told by IBM to go home because they can, because of technology allowing you to work from anywhere in the world, go home and work from your home. Well, then you have all the distractions of, you know, people doing yard work outside, the doorbell rings, the dog barks, you start doing your handy list. you get distracted. So these gentlemen were looking for a place where they could network and work alongside people, peers, and people that they can do business with. So that's how we came about. So the types of people that use our space are entrepreneurs, large organizations that just want to get out and meet other people, startups, nonprofits, small companies. So we do meetings, like, for instance, for IHG. They use our facility almost on a weekly basis, which is kind of surprising, but they love Roam, and they like to be there. So we have small startup nonprofit companies like Pebble Tossers. You know, so it's a place for anyone and everyone. We don't focus on one individual market. We're open to everyone, any type of market. So.
And do you find that it's mostly the small solopreneur, or is it now the big corporate entity that's doing the meetings? Where are the majority of your customers coming from?
Well, it's a twofold. It's about 50-50%. So 50% of it is entrepreneurs that are, you can become a member mm-hmm. at different levels depending on what your needs are, how often you're there, what you want out of it. And the other 50% are people that come for meetings, and those are normally larger corporations or large organizations that are having, whether it be a training, consulting, a board meeting, what have you, an event to get people to learn about their product.
Right. And could you just go, like I go to a Starbucks for a meeting and just pop in, or do you have to be a member?
And that's a great question. So you can come in, and the first section of Roam is called the community table. We have a large table, and then there's a coffee bar there, and you can come in that area and work.
So anybody
could walk in.
And then is there a fee for that?
There isn't if you stay in the community table area. Uh-huh. If you pass that area, it's a $20 a day fee to work at Roam for the day.
And then
memberships start at $99 and they go up to $300.
But in the community area, I can have coffee. I have access to Wi-Fi.
Absolutely. Best Wi-Fi around.
And then, but I cross a line and now I have to pay $20. What happens? What $20 of value occurs when I cross that line?
So when you pay $20, you can work in the cafe. So you go further into Roam and you get to network with other people. So it's not just the community table area. And you can use any of the space. So when we're not having large meetings in our larger meeting rooms, mm-hmm. we open those rooms for coworkers.
Okay, so then I can use a private room or whatever space that I need.
Yes. Now, as far as a small private room, you would have to pay for that. That's separately,
uh-huh.
like with a door.
Right.
That type of room.
Mm-hmm. All right, but I can rent space, too, if I've got a two-day training event. We want to do, I don't know, host training. We want to train some new network affiliates, you know, that we just open up in a new town. We can bring them all into town for a couple of days, and we can run you have like a training room or some meeting.
Oh, absolutely.
Rooms
we have large rooms. We do. We have desks that you can hook up your laptops to. They're on wheels, chairs. We have all the audiovisual is included in our rental space. And if you wanted to do that, you would call me.
And then you can coordinate catering if we want to have stuff. Or do you guys have your own food, or you coordinate food brought in, that kind of thing?
Yes, we have our own caterers, but you're also welcome to use your own caterers yourself.
And wow. You don't need Lee Cantor kind of money for a membership. No, one of the memberships is like $99 a month, right?
Right. The basic membership is $99 a month. And depending on what your needs are, if you need a mailbox, you need more, you know, you need hours of time in a meeting room per month, or you need day passes, then that would go up on your membership.
Now, what if I'm a member and then I have invited somebody in there? Do they have to pay to access
this
other space?
That's a great question. If you are a gold member or above, you receive day passes per month.
Mm-hmm.
So you would have a group of day passes, and if you're a consultant and you're meeting someone, a customer, a client,
right.
you would give them that day pass.
Now then, you're talking. So now Lee could be a member, and then I could.
Then you
can
come in for
passes.
Free
I'm
with my
this
passes.
Thing figured out.
You crack the code.
All right. So tell us a little bit about. I want to go back to the whole sales and marketing thing. Okay. Are you guys to the point where your phone just rings a lot and you're responding to inquiries? Are you out there kind of drumming up the business? And what risk, if any, do you face for what did you call it early on, Mr. Jacoteau? What'd you call it?
The risk.
When they fall off. The risk.
Defection. Client defection.
Defection. Yeah, that's what it was. I knew it wasn't infection. So, I mean, you guys are a business too, right?
Mm-hmm.
So,
absolutely.
Yeah, speak to some of that, if you will, a little
absolutely.
Bit.
Absolutely, sure. It's a little bit of both. There's two salespeople, myself and a woman named Yvonne Hill. And we are selling the meeting space itself. Most of our memberships are word of mouth. People come in, they hear about us. Every person that comes in, they usually tell five people, and that's how people join Rome. As far as the meetings, we are out looking for companies that do have offsite meetings. And it's interesting because, like I said, IHG, many companies have their own meeting space or
well, you
have
would
access
think they
to
do.
It.
They own all the hotels in town.
Exactly. But a lot of times, it's like you were talking about, it's more profitable to use other space or more cost effective, I should say. And a lot of companies run out of meeting space. They're always, they're constantly,
sense.
And they think that they're not going to, but most of them do.
Wow.
And those are the calls that we get. And those are the people that I'm looking for. So I go to many networking events, just like I did before in my previous job.
Right.
Trying to meet people and find out who the decision makers are and what type of meetings that we can host for them. I mean, we're a great alternative to a hotel.
And you can always meet them in a very cool place, right? You meet somebody.
Meet me at Rome.
Coffee's on you. No, I can tell you, I can vouch from personal experience. My wife was one of the very early ones who was encouraged to work from home at IBM because she's kind of loud. But I can tell you, there's a lot of time, and she does work from home quite a bit when she's not traveling. But the IBM, some of these very large organizations make tremendous use out of facilities like a Rome, so that so they can have a good professional but a comfortable atmosphere to conduct businesses. So surprisingly, the size of companies and the number of companies that use a facility like yours.
Yeah, and I think many people get bored. Either they get bored, they don't like the silence, they need a mixture. And that's what's so great about Rome. It's not a fixed space. And we do have some dedicated offices.
Oh, really?
Yes,
so
we do.
So you got that too?
Right. And I was going to tell you about that we have a cafe, we have small meeting rooms, we have shared booths, we have individual workstations, and we have large meeting co-working space.
Wow.
So there's different types. And we find that many people like that variety and they have the choice. So they're not stuck in one traditional type sales office or not stuck at home. They get a choice. They can come in 5 hours a week, 30 hours a week. They can go to multiple locations. They don't have to be in Dunwoody. They could go to Alpharetta and work and meet another client.
Right.
And now they're going to be able to go to Cobb Gallery and Buckhead.
Oh, so there's some...
Once you become a member of Rome, you can access
there's
any
some
of the rooms.
At Rome.
Yes, you
I
can
like
roam.
That. And parties? Like, can you put on a party? Like, have everybody come to Rome for the afternoon and cater a party? I guess you could do that, right?
We do events.
Okay.
We do not do alcohol.
Okay.
We do not have
all
an
right.
alcohol license.
Mike's out.
But we, our regular operating hours are Monday through Friday, 8 a.m. to 6. Now, that doesn't mean that we can't start a meeting at 7 because most of our meetings do start before 8.
Right.
So we're there very early. And we are doing some events and some meetings in the evening as requested.
So if somebody wanted to learn more, is there a website?
Absolutely. www.meetatrome.com. Or you can call my cell, which is 404-593-9009.
Fantastic. Well, stay with us, won't you?
Thank
we're going to visit.
Thank
with,
you so much for having me back. Appreciate
yeah.
it.
Well, we love having you back, and we'll do it again. And you know that I'm quite sincere when we when we say that. So please join us now on Atlanta Business Radio to have a conversation with a very patient yet very engaged. I feel like I saw a lot of head nodding. I don't know if I saw you write anything down, but you seem like you're getting some value out of these previous conversations. We have with us from a company called Making Ideas Visible. She's a facilitator, strategist, and visual thinker. Please join me in welcoming to the program Miss Julie. Stuart, how you doing?
I'm doing great. It's great to be here.
Well, we are absolutely delighted to have you. I can only imagine, and maybe we should have given you markers and had you stand at the flip chart since you were going last anyway, the mental images that must have been created in your head.
Give us some word images of, right. of how you experienced this last few minutes.
Well, I want to have a longer conversation with Mike about client retention and things like that.
You have some thoughts on that?
I do, because I'm positioning myself as a creative thought partner to mm-hmm. kind of expand how companies use me. So a lot of times folks will hire me just for one meeting, but then I realize the different ways that I can engage them in other aspects of their business.
So now what's the, why would a company hire you? What are they thinking?
So, yeah, for a variety of reasons. So sometimes it's because they want to add an interesting aspect to their meeting. Sometimes it's because they need help to design and facilitate a meeting. Sometimes it's because they want to come up with something kind of visual, take a strategic plan into some kind of visual imagery, just for a variety of reasons.
Now, sometimes, and I don't mean to diminish this, but they kind of look at this as a fun kind of thing and not really a meaningful type of thing in some cases, and you got to move them kind of, you got to educate them on the value strategically of how they can leverage this?
You know, I've been doing this work since 2007, and initially those conversations, I did have to explain the value a lot more. Mm-hmm. My industry mm-hmm. has exploded really in like the last 3 or 4 years. I don't know if you've seen the quick sketch drawings, those little videos.
And the infographics.
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, like GE has a commercial where they're drawing on the glass, and just the whole visual design thinking has really exploded the industry. So now the challenge for me is to differentiate myself. And I'm in the process of doing a rebrand. I also have a website that's coming out probably in the early part of the year that positions me much more as a strategist and facilitator and somebody who can really think through strategically. One of my special skills is sort of being in that place where ideas are just starting to kind of percolate and form, and I kind of help to conjure those out and give them metaphors and visual images to hang on to.
So now how does that take place? Like, is the group in a room and you're kind of a fly on the wall, or like
it's a little bit of both. So sometimes I can be the fly on the wall. Sometimes I'm working one-on-one with somebody. I work with a lot of creative entrepreneurs as well. I can facilitate small groups. Sometimes I'm the facilitator and I bring along a graphic recorder. So I've got a team and I can kind of flex and expand as needed.
Graphic recorder. That's the appropriate.
Did you make that up?
No, that's
really cool. So, it's like a consultant word.
So in my industry, we've got some branding issues. So you can call it graphic recording or graphic facilitation or visual mapping.
Not artists?
Some of folks in my industry call themselves artists. I think when I do the work, art is only maybe one quarter of it. So there's a big piece that's about listening. Mm. There's another piece about organizing the information and, you know, making it make sense so that when people look at it, they can understand and get the gist of the conversation that happened.
All right, so let's say we had this conversation right now, or we have the conversation with Bijan or Mike or Beth. Is it the kind of thing where you kind of get a rough draft together and then you go back and polish it up, or can you actually create something right then?
I do it live, absolutely. And
really?
That's exactly the way I prefer to work, because it's easier and faster for me. And it's really hard to describe the process because you're really kind of in a flow state.
Oh, I imagine.
So I'm listening, I'm holding chunks of information, I'm putting chunks on the paper, and as soon as the chunk goes up on the paper, I'm letting it go and another kind of chunk comes in. I'm holding about 10 different chunks at the same time. So it actually takes me a whole lot longer to not work live. And I've determined that I really hate it. So I pass those jobs off to, you know, illustrators on my team.
So when you're saying a chunk, like that could be a visual image?
Yeah, or a piece of the conversation. One of my earliest jobs was as a journalist, and I kind of think in terms of a journalist would, where I'm following the thread of the story, listening for the key quotes, you know, pulling all those things out. I don't translate people's words. I use exactly what they say, and then adding images to it at the same time.
So now let's talk about Mike again. I like to bring Mike. And you said you wanted to work with Mike, so, right? So Mike's working with a client, and then he's like, red light. You know, you can, you would now kind of visually draw like a stoplight and red.
Yeah, big red mark, maybe an explosion.
Like, how are you envisioning working with him? What was the going? What kind of images were going through your mind?
You want to see some chunks.
Oh, I want to see some chunks.
You mean I was supposed to be working while I was listening?
I know you were, because I bet you think visually.
Well, he, you know, and I do. So one of the things I was thinking about, because I do some process mapping with clients where we take clients through a process of how somebody experiences their business. So that's kind of what I was thinking about, Mike. You know, he, that's a lot of the things that he does with his clients is he looks at the whole experience, you know.
So in that case, you kind of have an idea of what a process should look like, and you're filling in blanks?
Not necessarily. No, and this is, and so this is a something that
is
I would
like
do.
Is this like an improv, or is
So what I do sometimes is I will give out a bunch of sticky notes to folks in the group, and I'm like, you guys put the process up, one piece of the experience by, you know, on a sticky note, and let's look back. And let's see what's missing, what's redundant.
So they could say, like, website, you know, white paper, phone call. Like
Right.
And you're doing something
visually? Or, no, a lot of times I'm making them do it.
Well, it's interesting to me that you went to Mike, because my mind went straight to Bijan, because I was thinking about the folks that he's working with, many of whom I suspect are still struggling with, in their own mind, but certainly in how to articulate and get this out. And so that's where my mind went, was with the folks that you work with.
Well, there is a great point you're making. This is something extremely new. I would say that in next, in last, you know, 6 to 12 months, there is another element emerging in building companies and creating values, and that is called creative design. Apple would not be where Apple is with iPhone without that.
Yeah.
So creative design and the visualization aspect of it is so important. Because when you look at the storefronts are becoming websites, right?
Right.
Sure. So you have a website that is visually delivering certain messages without a lot of words versus one that has a couple of essays written by Shakespeare, which one are you going to go to, right? So it is, right. It is the creative design. In fact, one of my partners is a professor from Georgia State, and he's heading the Department of the Creative Design, and he is amazing. He's just absolutely amazing. And you know,
I
this
might
is
know
a,
him.
Yeah, you probably know him, yeah. But that element of the creative design
is
so
important. But is
that
a challenge for some companies to kind of
it is.
Visually kind of communicate their
and
value
and
proposition?
Especially a specific. So I've found that it's the extreme left-brainers of the world, the engineers, the accountants, the scientists, who absolutely love visual thinking because it's so foreign to them. I mean, they're like, I just work with a bunch of IT folks from GE, and I was like swarmed afterwards. They were just blown away.
You're
you know?
Like the rock stars.
Yeah,
right?
And then I just a couple weeks ago, I was with McGladrey, who's an accounting firm of the middle market down on Sea Island. These folks were like all over me, and they were coming up to me with like different, like, we need you for insight meetings, and we need you for this and that. And so I'm actually going to have a conversation with several of them to be kind of, you know, and a consultant that they draw on throughout the year for various different projects.
So now when you're working with a client at that level, you know, you've gotten past kind of the value. They see the value once they've experienced it. Is that a challenge for you, that it's hard to get that first inroad
in? Not at this point in my work. When I first started out, there weren't, not a lot of companies were using graphic facilitation at the time. So if somebody hadn't seen it before, it was a little bit of a challenge. But once people see it, so I started doing some, you know, I do a couple of big conferences throughout the year, and which always generates a huge, you know, amount of work comes out of that because people see it and they experience and they get
it. So like you'll do like a CPA conference?
That was actually the very first piece of work I ever did was an accountants conference in Montreal.
Wow. So,
not a lot of visual imagery, let me tell you.
You're just drawing dollar signs over and over again?
Yeah.
Different colors?
So, and it's interesting, like, the different kinds of industries that have good imagery. Like, I just did a big meeting with some folks around climate change and forestry and agriculture. Lots of great images.
Sure.
Yeah, yeah.
What about in like healthcare? There must be a million.
I do.
Things.
Yeah, I do a fair amount of work in healthcare as well.
Now, are you finding that more clients are becoming more experience centered? That they're that they're afraid that maybe their service or product is commoditized, and they have to do something to elevate it from beyond "I'm an accountant that does accounting
exactly.
like every other accounting firm."
And that's one of the reasons a couple of these folks at McGladrey, because they are looking to be value added. I mean, they can do the regular accounting stuff, but they want to provide their clients with a an experience sort of above and beyond. And they thought, well, we can bring you in and you can do strategic planning with some of our clients that need it. We can draw
So you're
models.
A value add for them,
for them
when they're working with their clients
exactly.
to show, look at how much more. So that way then when the client or prospective client is comparing CPAs, they go, well, the other guy didn't have this.
Right, right. Yeah. Or it's probably really good for client retention.
There you have it.
I would come full circle.
Back to Mike.
It always comes back to Mike. But I know you got to be thinking, Lee, when we do on-site work and we go and we set up in conferences or conference rooms with professional service outfits to have you or
this
someone on your team.
Element, right.
Because while we're facilitating these conversations, I would think that would be incredibly powerful.
Yeah,
now, is your work only drawing or is it also kind of web design and like creating visual video?
So I,
or do you draw
good question.
Oh, that's funny.
So I position myself more as a strategist facilitator, and I have people that I can give that other kind of work to do videos and illustration.
But
kind of stuff.
I would imagine that the visual component, a lot of people aren't doing video very strategically.
Right, right.
You know,
so
they're capturing
I help,
visual content, but that may not be strategic.
And I work on the conceptual part of that, but not so much the execution. Like, I've done a couple of those videos, and that was enough. Because it's like you're doing take after take after take,
right.
And I'm, you know, I like to be in the moment and in and out. That kind of thing. I could never be an actor. You got to know what you're good at.
Exactly. And only do that.
Yeah.
Well, what an absolute delight to have you join us this afternoon. Thank you so much. All right. So where can our listeners go to learn more and have a meaningful conversation with you about some of this
my
stuff?
My website is Making Ideas Visible. And on Twitter, I'm Julie Stewart, Stuart. I was an early, very early adopter of Twitter.
Good for
like
you.
Before anybody even knew what was happening on Twitter.
Very cool.
Well, thank you so much for being part of the show today.
Thanks for having me.
And thanks to all of our guests. This is Lee Cantor for Stone Peyton. We will see you all next time on Atlanta Business Radio.